This is 4:55 on Monday, October 10th. Okay. Please do sign in for attendance. No questions today, but just attendance. So we'll do that. We'll see how well I do. I have a cold that I got over the weekend. Try to persist through things here. So we're in chapter 4, and recall that this is about the networking layer, and we're going to talk, beginning in the next section, about the IP protocol. But first, we want to talk about what does a router do and how does it work inside, some different models and some of the issues that arise within routers about having good performance, able to keep up with the network and so forth. So that's the plan for the first part today. So the general scheme of a router is that there's some sort of processing on the inputs. We'll look into all of this in detail. Some sort of way of deciding where packets arriving on an input port should go, and typically some sort of higher level computational device that runs the routing algorithms themselves, the things that fill in the forwarding tables, if you will. So, the input port on the left side there. Recall that a router works at layer 3 of the protocol stack. So that means that there are physical layer issues that have to be dealt with, and link layer issues that have to be dealt with before the router can get at the layer 3 stuff that it wants to work with. So this is the same sort of thing that occurs on your host computers as well. This is your wireless LAN device. Does exactly the same stuff. Your Ethernet port does all of this stuff. It's just sort of a package typically. So you pull that apart, and eventually you get at the link at the network layer header that tells you where the packet is going, and that's done. The process starts within the input port, but is finished by the switch fabric and the output port eventually. So, of course, the goal here is that you can take the data coming off the line at full line speed and push it through the router to the output ports without losing anything. That's somewhat wishful thinking, of course, because depending on the traffic patterns, you can have, you know, if you have 4 input ports with traffic all coming at full speed, all going to one output port of the same speed, well, there's not much you can do about that, right? You're going to lose packets in that case. Why is it saying this? I don't have this problem anymore. I'm not using the cert. I don't need it today, so it was working before. Okay, so you know, buffering is the way that we deal with traffic that comes too fast for a particular destination over a short period of time. If it's over a long period of time, there's nothing we can do about it. And so we can put buffering into the input ports in the case that we need to protect against going faster than this so-called switch fabric can go with the traffic. Won't help us with the output, the problem of having too much data for an output, but of course there are physical limits on how fast this can go as well, and we may end up waiting to do that. So there are principally three kinds of switching fabrics. This one we're going to look at. We're going to look at each of these in detail, so don't worry too much about it right now, except to see that this one uses essentially memory. You can build a router out of any computer, workstation, laptop, whatever, and if you do, it will be of this model. Another variety says that we attach the input ports and the output ports to a common bus and somehow figure out how to put data onto the bus and extract it from the bus onto the output ports. We'll look at that one. And then finally, a crossbar switch has the ability to attach all inputs in some permutation to all outputs in some permutation all at once, so that they can all be sending at once. Problem with the bus is that it really only allows one input port to be using the bus at a time. Yes? Memory is like is just like your laptop or a workstation or something. We're going to look at this. Okay. Let's do it that way. So this is the kind of router that you can build yourself, and if you have a Linux or a Windows system and you enable routing on it, this is what you get. So the input port is just your normal network input port. Indeed, there is a bus, but the packet is copied into memory as the first thing that happens, and then the processor, which is not shown here, looks at what's in that packet and decides where it needs to go and copies it to the output port. It's like port forwarding. Well, port forwarding is an instance of this kind of routing. The issue being sort of from a hardware level with this kind of switching is that you have typically in a computer these days one system bus that network stuff attaches to, and so data has to be copied over that bus into memory once, then copied out of memory onto the bus again. And so, you know, if we're trying to do data at say 1 gigabit per second over this link, this can go 1 gigabit per second. The memory bus is seeing 2 gigabits per second, as is the memory, just to pick numbers out of the air. Okay, so we're somehow needing more resources in here for the bus. Can be more of a hardware-y sort of thing. So this one, this is what you implement when you implement routing with. Pardon?
This isn't reused in the real world practice necessarily. Usually they're or does it just depend on the quality?
It depends on the particular routers. Your home routers are going to be this way.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and aren't they more susceptible to like remote attacks than just a straight hardware solution?
Yeah, probably, but that has more to do with the sort of the way that you're using a general purpose CPU here than the fact that this is the architecture, I'd say. Yeah. It's the general purposeness of the processor and the system code that it's running that make it an attractive target, I'd say. Because the other ones are going to be, I mean, they're going to have a lot more hardware, but they're still going to be, to some sense, software as well. So, the bus version of this says that you've got a packet in an input port, and there's logic in the input port itself to figure out which output port it needs to go to. And so you can, you know, essentially it's a kind of processor on the input port that says, I need to send this data to that output port, so I will reserve the bus for that purpose and sort of directly put it onto the bus in such a way that the output port needs to pick, knows it needs to pick it up and put it in its take responsibility for it. Yeah.
In this case, is the routing table still handled by the routing processor?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. The routing tables that these guys use is going to be stored in them by the higher level routing processor.
Okay. Okay. Only, their processor only deals with
only deals with forwarding. Yeah. Yeah. Because routing compared with forwarding is a very slow process. Okay. Right. Forwarding needs to go at the speed of all the incoming lines. Routing only changes things every little while. For some definition of little while. Bigger while than forwarding. So the limitation here, see, that now the packets are only going over the bus once, so that's a good thing. Ultimately, you're limited by how fast you can make the bus run. And these days, routers and switches in the backbone of the internet probably have definitely upwards of 128 input ports, maybe up towards 1,000 input ports, all going at potentially up to a few hundred megabits per second, maybe gigabits per second. And the question becomes, it's still the case that while the bus is in use, you can't use it for anything else. So if you're going to have 128 input ports and you want to support them all, the bus has to be 128 times as fast as the links. Well, that's an engineering challenge. Who's a computer engineer? Somebody in here is a computer engineer, right? You're a computer engineer, Levi. Right? So making buses go fast is a challenge.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting math that goes into switching packets extremely fast.
Yeah.
At the basic level, so you don't have to worry about worrying the software to slow you down or anything.
Right. But even apart from that, then there's still the electrical issue of making the bus go fast, right? And that can be a limiting factor. So the observation here was Cisco 5600. I mean, this is 5-6 year old technology now. So it was 32 gigabits per second, probably supported 32 ports, and you know that's good for a pretty good size enterprise. Except that the link speeds keep going up, right? And so where 5 or 6 years ago we had 1 gigabit per second Ethernet, now we're talking about 10 gigabit per second Ethernet. So for local area networks. So that's the limitation there, is you got to make the bus go fast, so you can't make the bus go electrically fast. So don't they show us a picture? No picture. All right, well, the other picture was we'll just go back to it. Was the so-called crossbar switch, and then if you're fortunate enough to have a different destination in mind for the packets on each of the inputs, you can do a permutation and switch all of the packets all at once onto the output. Now, of course, you're never so lucky, and there's sort of engineering studies of the statistics of traffic that suggest how big a fraction of the theoretical n times bandwidth that you get here that you can really use. But still, electrically, it's easier to get more capacity this way than that way, even if it is more complicated, right? And it becomes statistical instead of deterministic, right? Here, if you make this bus go n times faster than the inputs, then you can process every input on every cycle. So, okay. Other things that they do here, for reasons that will become clear in a moment, is that sometimes they actually switch. They actually, in the input ports, carve up the packets. IP packets, say, which can have length from 40 up to typically around 1500. So variable size. They carve those up into fixed size chunks, which again helps them deal with the statistical nature of the problem of having more traffic from one port than from another one. It gets a better chance of being able to use all of the resources of that switching fabric at once. Okay, that was the inside. And then on the outside, of course, there's the data link layer and line termination stuff that we always have to do. The output typically has queuing in case that you have more traffic destined for this link in the short run than you can handle. And it's interesting, as soon as you have queuing in a system, one of the things that you face as a designer is, okay, I got multiple things available to me, which one should I send next? Right? And there are some obvious answers to that, and there are some not so obvious answers to that. Right? The obvious answer is, well, the first one that got there. Right? And that's one scheduling discipline that you can implement on a queue. But you can also impose priorities on queues. You can impose a desire to fairly share amongst multiple connections going through that queue. A whole bunch of different things that you can do at any point where you have a queue. And so that's this thing called the scheduling discipline. Well, the other thing that happens is when a output buffer fills up, you have to toss things. That leads to buffer overflow. That's congestion. I mean, another word for that is congestion, right? So this is now really where we see the source of congestion and the packet drops. How much buffering should there be? Rule of thumb. A round trip time's worth. That's this one. A round trip time's worth at whatever speed the link is going. In other words, what is that? That's the bandwidth delay product, which is back here again. The book gives a reference to a paper about this that I really feel like I need to go look at, or maybe one of you needs to go look at. And tell us about it. My intuition says that this is too much buffering, because a packet arriving at that buffer incurs a round trip's time's worth of delay just going through that buffer, which essentially doubles the round trip time, which suggests that you need twice as much buffering, and that just doesn't seem like a stable situation if that's really the right rule. There's been some more recent study, and I think it's included in that same paper reference from the book, that says the amount of buffering you need actually decreases with the number of flows that are going through the router because of the statistical nature of the flows. And I think that's actually a good thing because this, 250 milliseconds, you arrive at that buffer, it is going to be 250 milliseconds before your packet leaves. And that's a long, long time in internet terms. It's as much time as it took even 250 milliseconds is probably too generous. But regardless, it's as much as you estimated for the whole round trip time. So it won't break TCP. TCP won't determine that packet has been lost if it suffers that at one router, because of the deviation, we hope. I guess that's the if there's a lot of this going on, the deviation will indicate it, and eventually the round trip time estimation will jump or adjust itself to reflect this amount of queuing delay. Okay, well, and then recently there's been this whole issue about, I think we mentioned it before, so-called dark buffers that exist in the internet, devices with too much buffering, home routers that have megabytes of buffering just because they can, just because it's hard to buy chips with less storage than that.
Also, it looks good on the packaging.
Oh, and it looks good on the packaging.
It's got more.
Yes, you see what happens when that's going on. When there's too much buffering, is that you're sort of drawing out the round trip time. You're preventing TCP from getting its congestion signals because you need to be throwing things away for TCP to know that it's supposed to be slowing down.
I have a quick question about that. If the window only increases linearly at that point, why is a buffer window that's bigger so bad? Because it's only going to increase linearly after a point.
Because yes, it will increase linearly, but it'll just keep increasing, and the buffer will get more and more full. Okay, with no with no benefit, right?
Yeah. Okay.
If the buffer is getting more and more full, then you really should be slowing down. Right, you're going faster than the network can handle it. So I think they don't talk about this in the book. There's a few paragraphs that follow this discussion that talk about ways to indicate to users, specifically TCP users, the fact that congestion is occurring. See, the problem with the output queuing that I've described up to now is what? We've got an output queue, say it's big, it's filling up. That means that the fact that it's filling up means there is congestion. Right? Maybe short-term congestion, but it is congestion. But what you know is that if all the senders keep doing that, it's going to what? It's going to keep filling up until it gets full. So there's sort of no indication of early indication of congestion. So the proposal, or one of the proposals that has been made, is that as the buffer fills up, you get more and more aggressive about dropping packets, even though it's not full. Right? So pick a packet out of some stream and throw it away. That will be taken as a congestion signal for that stream. And yet we're still in the regime where the early loss detection of TCP will work, because the other packets around it get through, and so you'll get ACKs for those. You'll see your duplicate ACKs and say, oh, congestion, I better slow down.
So essentially, you know, as it's increasing, so as the buffer's coming up quickly, it just gives slowly stronger and stronger
right. Indications to slow down. That's called random early detection, RED algorithms. And, you know, as long as the buffer is not too full, there's some threshold, we say, okay, everything's fine, don't worry about it. If it gets full, of course, then we have to drop everything, and that's worse, right? So trying to sort of send early signals has been an area of research to make this work better. Okay, we may need queuing on the inputs as well. This causes interesting problems. So the queuing on the outputs is primarily to reflect the fact that you have more traffic than a particular output can handle. What if you have more traffic than the switching fabric can handle? Then you have congestion on the inputs, and you face interesting problems like this thing called head-of-line blocking, which is illustrated here. Suppose we have a switch fabric that only lets one packet in a given cycle go to a particular output port, and we have two input ports with traffic for that output, then one of them will get to go and the other one won't. But notice that if you've implemented your queuing naively here, a naive queuing discipline here, I've got two packets for the red destination. This red one is not allowed to go, but the green one can't go either because of first come, first serve. So that's called head of line blocking. What does it take to fix it? More circuits. Okay. More circuits. Any questions about switches or routers?
I have one question.
Good.
About the RED. I was kind of confused, because if it's full, then it just drops all the time.
Sure, yeah.
And if it was above a minimum threshold, but below the like max threshold, it says like it drops with a certain probability, so that
right.
Are they saying that it's not going to drop every packet, just occasionally?
That's
like,
right.
Does it kind of do it fairly across each end-to-end connection?
Well, it does it randomly, which is in some sense
fair.
Randomly fair.
Okay.
that's a kind one kind of fairness.
Okay.
It's a kind of fair. This is an interesting area. It turns out that random fairness is much, much easier to implement than real fairness, right?
Well, first, you'd have to define fairness.
So real fairness would say that if I zapped your packet, I wouldn't zap your packet until I'd zapped everybody else's packet. I wouldn't zap your packet again until I'd zapped everybody else's packet. Okay. Well, that requires, of course, that I keep track of whose packets I've zapped. All right? Lots of complexity. Whereas random fairness says, even after I zapped your packet, your probability is still the same as it ever was of getting zapped again, but, you know, okay, so that's, and this idea of random fairness actually crops up in a number of areas in computer science, so that's kind of fun, and it's real easy to implement. The other kind of way that you can do it is you can implement actually a kind of deterministic fairness by sort of cycling through by counting and zapping things when certain bits are turned on, but that's people don't typically do that because the whole thing is statistical anyway. The whole traffic of the internet is statistical, so this is just more statistics. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about IP and how it works, Internet Protocol. We've talked about the transport layer. Okay, well, this is kind of a funny diagram. Where's the data in this diagram that's being carried? It's up here, right? If you look at these things as the headers, you've got your physical layer header, your link layer header, your network layer header, your transport layer header, and then the data, or the application data. That's not the picture that they're drawing here, actually. They're saying, what's in the network layer? Okay, this is not what's in the header, but what's in the network layer. There's routing protocols that run here. There's the forwarding process. There's the IP protocol itself. And then there's this protocol, the Internet Control and Management Protocol. Something like that. We'll see when we get there. So, what does an IP datagram look like? Remember, this is just another header that's stuck on in front of the header for TCP or UDP, and then is followed by the application data. So, the IP layer, we have, and these diagrams, sorry for the diversion here, these diagrams are very common. In talking about networking, they represent 32-bit words, and you can tell from where the vertical lines are how big things are. So just be aware of that when you see them. So we start with the IP version number, currently 4, headed towards 6 someday. What comes after that 4 is entirely dependent on that 4 being 4, right? When the version is 6, the format of what follows is different. So this is an IP version 4 datagram. It is followed by the length of the header, which is this amount, so that you know where to find the header for the next layer, the UDP or TCP header. Type of service is not usually used these days. See, there are things that people have ideas. They get into standards, and they never really pan out. And then we waste a little bit of bandwidth on them in every packet. Total length of the datagram, that is beginning to end. This stuff in the next 32-bit word is all associated with fragmentation, which is what we're going to talk about on the next slide. Time to live, a misnomer, if there ever was one. This field is decremented each time a packet passes through a router. So it may start out with something around 30 in it these days, and each time it passes through a router, it gets decremented. If it ever reaches zero, you get back one of these ICMP messages that says, time to live exceeded. Why? What's the purpose of this? Why would they do this?
To keep it from going too many hops.
Well, even worse. From getting caught in a loop and living forever. Okay? This was a real danger, still is a real danger, because of the possibility of routing loops getting established. And any traffic that falls into one of those is not ever going to come out. And if you don't do something to kill it, it's going to use up all the bandwidth in that loop. So,
how does it get in a loop, though? Because, I mean, if all that, the packets are pumping out of the network are going on to loop, like, it has to be, I mean, not all of them. Like, what causes them to actually get into
a loop? That happens because of the routing algorithms. Remember, the forwarding piece of this is really stupid. It just says, I've got this packet, it's supposed to go there.
Right.
Does that over and over again. If the routing algorithm, which is a distributed algorithm and therefore not always able to see the actual topology of the whole network, temporarily puts those different forwarding engines into a configuration that has a loop, that's how it would happen.
For like a finite time, like one host might be always sending things into loop until it changes.
Until it changes, yeah. And that could be a fairly long time by the standards of forwarding, anyway. Okay. All right, so that's to keep packets from looping forever. The upper layer is an identifier of which protocol number is going to have the next header here. In IP version 6, I believe they changed it so that this field is not used in the IP header, but rather the first field of the actual next layer header says what it is. I think. We'll see. A header checksum. Remember that we said that UDP added a checksum over the whole packet to the IP protocol. IP just has a checksum over its own header. And again, this was implemented in days when memories and networks and so forth were not as reliable. And they felt that there was some danger that things, particularly the source and destination addresses, would get corrupted, and things would be sent off in wrong directions uselessly. So using the header checksum allows each router along the way to make sure that the header has not been corrupted and therefore it's still doing what was asked of it. I guess it wasn't felt as evil to deliver a corrupted data fragment to the correct destination because they didn't put in a checksum over the whole packet.
And header is not just the IP header, it's the entire header.
I believe it's the entire header, isn't it? I don't know. No, it may be just the IP header. Because, no, it's got to be just the header, the IP header, because it doesn't know
right.
how the other headers work. Yeah. Doesn't know how big they are. Okay, then to the good stuff. An IP datagram always contains its source IP address and its destination IP address, which we're going to look at in detail in a moment. And then finally, there are some options at the IP level that you can request, but we're not going to talk about those. Yeah, Matt?
I thought UDP added a source. IP only had destination.
No. What does UDP add? Somebody else.
Checksum and port.
A port number. UDP adds the port number. Port numbers. Source and destination.
For some reason I thought IP only had destination.
You thought wrong. Okay. It has both. Because, for example, when this time to live gets reduced to zero, there's a message back to the source saying time exceeded. And it's also used, it's very practical to have the source here because the destination, when it gets the message, typically needs to know where it came from.
Yeah. So is the time to live, is that like a standard that's like 30 pretty much for everything? Or
no.
What happens if there's something that's just more than 30 hops? Like,
well, okay, so it's a byte field. It can be as big as 256.
So
it's kind of an engineering decision about where you started. Nothing in the internet is 256 hops away. And you can tell me I was wrong 20 years from now or something. Mars. Or, Mars has other problems.
So that's arbitrary, though. It's not really necessarily always 30. It depends on it, who decides that. It's just the
Apple. It's a operating system configuration. I think... I'm not sure that...
Do they adjust it based upon feedback of too many, or is it kind of set in some per...
I don't know. I'm going to stop answering now, because I don't know. I'm not even sure that it's something that you can adjust with the socket options. It may be, but from the application level you can adjust it, but I don't know. And I don't know where you look. It's probably in, you know, procnet. On a Linux system, it's probably in procnet, inet, something or other. And on a Windows system, it's in the registry somewhere. But what it is and how you change it, I don't know. Okay. Well, before we talk about routing and forwarding and the like, let's talk about fragmentation. So one of the problems of practical networking as opposed to theoretical networking is that different kinds of links support essentially frames of different sizes. You know, Ethernet supports about 1500 as the frame size, but a point-to-point link over a serial connection may support only 600 bytes as the frame size. And remember that IP was created back in the day when it was completely unclear what sort of link layer technology was going to win. So they designed in this mechanism that says... I'm perfectly willing to take packets of an arbitrary size, and at the IP layer, I will fragment them down to the size that it needs to be so it can go across any given link. So I'm sending a packet here. It's long. This is the header and this is the body. The blue is the header and the red is the body. It gets to this router, which now needs to go out over this link that has a shorter maximum transmission unit. So we turn this IP packet into multiple IP packets, which then progress through the network separately, getting to the destination and get put back together again before they get delivered to what? The transport layer. Right, the transport layer never has to see fragmented packets.
So, does the IP layer guarantee the correctness of the reordering?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So let's look at how it uses those fields in the.
Each of those headers are identical except for the size, right? Like they would all have.
We're gonna look at what's in those headers.
Okay.
So these are the fragmentation fields and the length field of the original packet. The source and destination are indeed identical. But we take we take the packet that's too big and we break it up into, in this case, three pieces. Notice that the length field, this is the length field of the total packet that's in the IP header, now reflects the MTU of the underlying link. We put in a sort of random number. That's a 16-bit field, I believe, that will be used at the destination to tie these three fragments together. We put in a 1-bit flag that says, this is not the whole thing, guy. Hold on. this is only a piece of it. And we put in an offset field that says, where relative to the whole packet does this fragment belong? And so the last fragmentation flag is 0. It says there's no more to come after this. The fact that the offset is non-zero says that this is not a whole packet, right? That would be the danger, right? We have to be able to distinguish between the last fragment of a fragmented packet and a complete packet. We do that by seeing that the frag flag is 0, but the offset is non-zero. Okay? The last one may be short relative to the MTU. The offsets are expressed in 8-byte units. Why? To save a few bits. Okay? So with that, then, when we get those packets at the destination, the IP layer will put them back together again and deliver them upward to the transport layer. In IP version 6, they got rid of this mechanism because they said this is additional work for routers that they shouldn't have to do. It would be much better if the source would take care of fragmentation.
So the application layer. Is that what you mean?
Well, no, they actually I slightly misspoke. Routers in IPv6 do not do fragmentation. The source does fragmentation. So this kind of mechanism is still there, but routers won't do it.
So the source
is the sending host. The source is the sending host.
So the transport will get each of these 1,500 like packets as their own thing, right? Instead of a and then each individual fragment can be actor.
I'm confusing myself now. I have to look this up because it could be either way. I thought that in fact it had a IP layer fragmentation, but it may not. If it doesn't, then it's up to the transport layer to make it work. I will have to look that up. Anyway, the idea was just that it was too much work for routers too much complexity in routers to have to do this. Especially when you think about that process that we described earlier about how to make a router go fast, right? You want fairly dumb circuitry on the input port to look at the destination and make small adjustments to the header of the packet, like decrementing the checksum by one, decrementing the time to live by one, and not be worried about how to do a heavyweight operation of producing more packets out of this one that take up more space, which raises issues of memory management and all kinds of things that get complicated, when really what you want to do is go fast. So I have to look and see whether that mechanism still exists in the IP layer at all, because I don't remember. Okay, I think I've gone over time. Thank you for your patience. And next time we will talk about IP addressing.